Welcome back to 20VC with me, Harry Stebbings, and I'm very excited for our show today because not only is he CEO of one of Wall Street's darling companies, he's a fitness machine, he's an incredible leader, and so with that, I'm delighted to welcome Todd McKinnon, co-founder and CEO at Okta, providing one trusted platform to secure every identity, from customers to your workforce. Prior to their IPO in 2017, Todd raised over $229 million for the company from some of the best in the business, including Sequoia, Andreessen Horowitz, Greylock, Koestler, and Floodgate, to name a few. Prior to founding Okta, Todd was VP of Development at Salesforce.com, where he spent an incredible 5 years, and before that enjoyed an 8-year run in the software development team at PeopleSoft. I do also have to say a huge thank you, though. This schedule was a total team effort, so huge thanks to Frederick Karras at Okta, Ryan Coulson at Okta, Pat Grady at Sequoia, Vinod Koestler, Anil Bushri. My word, such a team effort, and I so appreciated your help there. But before we dive into the show today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Check them out at carta.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20VC listeners get 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. But that's enough of these terrible British tones, so let's hand over to Todd McKinnon, co-founder and CEO at Okta.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Todd, what can I say? This is such a joy to do. I think I've spoken to so many people before this. Ryan Coulson, Frederick Karras, Ben Horowitz, Pat Grady. So thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm excited to be here. I think you've talked to everyone I know and all of my friends. You've exhausted the list.
Pretty much, yeah. The whole camp table. Talk to them all. And it means that I've actually done no work on the schedule because they've done it all for me. But I do want to start with a little bit on you and set some context. It's been an incredible journey with Okta. But take me back. What was the founding moment with Okta?
Okta started in 2009, and at the time I was running engineering at Salesforce. It was a great job. I was managing the team. I'd been there 6 years. I'd seen that company grow. And from when I started, it was really a kind of a basic online contact management app, and it grown over the 6 years into a fully programmable platform. At the same time, the cloud computing industry had really sprung up around apps like Salesforce, but also things like infrastructure. We had Amazon Web Services coming out, S3, EC2. You had collaboration apps like Gmail and Google Apps for Domains, it was called at the time. And Salesforce was great, but it was clear to everyone that was working there and a lot of people in the industry that everything was going to have a cloud alternative, everything in the IT stack. And what I kept thinking about, like what opportunities there would be to build companies in that transition, because that's a big transition. And whenever there's a platform shift in terms of how applications are built and how services are delivered, whether it's PCs or mobile or in this case, the cloud, there's a big opportunity to build new companies, or at least you have the best opportunity to build new companies. And I just couldn't be the person that didn't take a shot given that transition was happening. And so Okta was really a kind of a macro bet on a transition to a new wave of technology.
And before we go into kind of the more micro of taking that transition bet, I do have to ask, I spoke to Anil Bushri before the call, and he said in particular, when you think back to your time at PeopleSoft, like what were your biggest takeaways from your time at PeopleSoft that really stuck with you in terms of how you think about building Okta?
It's really important. So Okta is my third job. So I worked at PeopleSoft where I started as an engineer and worked there for 8 years and then went over to Salesforce for 6 years. And then I've worked at Okta for 12 years. So it was my first job. And like a lot of things, your first job is super impressionable on you. PeopleSoft was an amazing company for a lot of reasons, but particularly it was culturally, it was all about company that felt like the employee's company. you know, it was an HR company, right? So it made HR software. So a lot of people think it was because it was an HR company, but we used to talk internally that it was really because it was the people's company, right? It was like the employees were empowered, it was a great place to work, great place to collaborate. That really made an impression on me. And I think that it's probably the biggest influence on what we've tried to do at Okta in terms of the culture. I want every person at Okta to feel like it's their company and feel like as hard as they work, they'll be productive. There's not going to get a lot of things get in their way. They can have a lot of, you know, direct connection between their effort and their energy and the results they see in the company and in the industry.
I love that kind of ownership mentality. If we go from like PeopleSoft to Salesforce, obviously you saw Salesforce in the most insane levels of hypergrowth. When you think about the takeaways from Salesforce, what were the core ones for you there?
Salesforce was another amazing company. It seems like an obvious thing today with the success they've had. But back at the time, cloud was new. The idea that you would want to have everything as a service, all your apps, all your infrastructure, that was a new idea. So the coolest thing about Salesforce was that we were clearly the leader, right? At PeopleSoft, it was like there was a company, you know, SAP, which was the preeminent ERP company, and PeopleSoft was basically trying to be number two to SAP. But Salesforce was trying to be number one in this new world, which was really fun and really invigorating. It was like, we're creating this new world. No one thinks we can make this new world where computing is done from the internet and you don't own software, you don't manage the software, and it's this whole new paradigm. And that was, being that leader, that was really fun to work on and really energizing.
I'm sure it was. If we kind of take that one logical step further, then we have the jump and starting Okta. And I spoke to Pat before the show, and he mentioned that I had to ask about the discussion with your wife when you came home. And, you know, this is famously kind of mid-financial crisis, I think it was. So what was that discussion like and how did it play out?
I remember it like it was yesterday, as you can imagine. I think the big takeaway from this story is, especially for entrepreneurs or really people doing anything that's different or risky, just remember that while it feels scary, and by definition, risk is uncertain and scary, everything that's done that's big seems scary and unlikely when it started. So if you roll the clock back, I talked a little bit about this before. I had a great job at Salesforce. It was kind of the preeminent job in cloud computing, right? Salesforce was the cloud leader. I was running engineering. I was doing great there. But I thought that it was likely that there would be this opportunity to create these, you know, big new companies in this cloud transition. I kept thinking about it and I wrote a business plan and I kept talking to people. The hardest thing about it was deciding to leave that great position at Salesforce. So when I finally made the decision in my own mind that I was going to do this and I was going to give up this great company and this great team and go out there on my own, the first thing I really had to do was talk to my wife, Roxanne, about it. And Roxanne and I were different in that I'm more risk tolerant. I can see the upside, the downside. I can, you know, kind of mitigate against it, I guess, in my own mind. And she's a little bit more risk averse. She believes that in her thinking, either you have a job at a well-known company, reputable company, or you're unemployed. There's really no middle ground. I had to talk to her about this decision. So I remember it like it was yesterday one of the reasons I remember is because it was right during the financial crisis. It was the end of 2008 when the financial system was freezing up, Harry. It was like, you know, Lehman Brothers collapsed. A big bulge bracket investment bank went out of business. Like, they ran out of money. They had no more money in their accounts. People were speculating about who was going to be the next big bank and how the financial system was going to freeze up. And another part of this story is we had just started a family. So we had a 6-month-old daughter, and my wife was taking some time off work to be with our daughter. And she was at home watching the news. And so on the news all day would be, you know, when's the next Lehman Brothers? Is it the next Great Depression? So I come home from work and she's, you know, taking in all this information and really worried about, obviously, when you have a new family, you're worried about the future and providing for your family. And I come home, you know, I didn't know her headspace at the time, but I came home and I said, honey, I'm going to quit my job. She looked at me and it was literally this look of, and she said it out loud. She said, "What, are you crazy?" You know, she used some colorful language there to emphasize the crazy.
I'm sure this is a PG-13 content version.
I'm editing it for you. And it was like, I just remember it hit me like when she said that to me, it hit me how big of a decision it was that I was making. And it was scary.
Well, I mean, that's my question. It's like, it's actually an irreversible decision. You can't go back, you know, 5 months later and say, oh, I fucked up. Can I come back now? Or maybe you can, but it's not obvious. How do you think
it's you're right. It's like you can't, theoretically, you could do things to go back in the direction, but you can't unwind it like that.
So how do you think about reversible versus irreversible decisions?
The decisions are less reversible than others, but I think there are very few irreversible decisions. I think if you think about really irreversible decisions, you could get into paralysis. So I tend to think about it as time frames. Like if we make this decision, how long will it take to get momentum and have effect? And how long will it take to unwind and change directions? So I don't think of it as binary, like reversible or irreversible. I think about it as the ones that are long lead time and long, it'll be like getting an aircraft carrier going and turning the aircraft carrier will be really hard. Or I think about ones that are more iterative and you could just change really fast. As that goes, I think that the ones that are more longer lead time to change or longer lead time to take effect, especially over the last 5 or 6 years, I found myself really focusing on how I can prep myself and gather the information and get the context to make it a high hit rate on those decisions in terms of accuracy, and how I can make sure I have a good process for going through the mechanics of making those decisions.
That's what I often hear is like, you know, build the process, build the framework. And then I think people say that and then they go head versus heart. You know, the biggest mistake is I always follow my head and I should follow my heart. And it seems to kind of fly in the face of the process and the framework. How do you think about head versus heart when decision making with that in mind?
I think the work has to be done ahead of time. I think a lot of the problem comes in they're trying to cram for the test, you know? They have a big impactful decision that's going to take a lot of time to implement or a lot of time to unwind. So it's something you have to get right. And then they get to the point where they have to make the decision and they're not prepared. So they haven't done the work, gathering the information, building the context, being informed, talking to people to have the information at their fingertips or in their consciousness to make the decision. So it's kind of a continuous process. Like when you think about my position now running a 3,000 person company, it's a continuous process of making sure you're having information inputs that can arm you to make those decisions. That's really important. And then specifically on head versus heart, I think it's, especially on those long lead time decisions, I think it's really important that you're able to make effect good decisions. You have to be able to argue with yourself. You have to be able to, in your head, hold opposing viewpoints. To basically argue with yourself and say, what if this is true? What if this is not true? If you get too much with your heart and too much, you lose the ability to see things from both sides. I think that hinders your ability to make good decisions.
Bit of a kind of personal one, but you know, when you realize that it was such a scary decision, often when I come to that realization of bluntly the momentous element of the decision and being scared, I move to paralysis and then I move to safety, like flight to safety. How do you think about actually progressing in the right way and not just retreat to safety?
So in the specific, it's funny looking back on the decision to start Okta, when I told my wife about this decision and saw the shock and horror in her eyes, you know, the first things we did to work through it is we decided to, she told me and I agreed that if we were going to do this, I had to make a presentation to her that we're kind of laying out the pros and cons. I did what any logical engineer would do. I made this PowerPoint and I kind of argued my case. And it's pretty interesting to look back on it today. Kind of an accurate history can be retold, right? Post facto. And if you look at this today, it's kind of more of an accurate reflection of what was going on then. So you can link to it in the show notes. You can find it online. But now it's like, Todd created this company and it's very successful and the cloud transition happened. But if you look at this PowerPoint where I was presenting my case to Roxanne, there was a lot of CYA in there. There was a lot of like what would happen when it didn't work out, you know? So, you know, oh, when it doesn't work out, it's, I can get another job. If I can't get another job, my job at Salesforce probably wouldn't have been safe in that scenario. So if anyone ever says that I knew this would work totally, they can look at that and it's proof that it probably wasn't a total sure thing.
When we think about kind of you as the leader, you know, I was talking to Frederick before the show and he said specifically, you've got to ask Todd, what makes for a great enterprise software entrepreneur today? And how does he think about that?
I think the biggest, most important characteristic that's positively correlated with success is just the ability to keep going. The ability to, every company hits problems and has to power through some tough spots. Some companies, especially the companies you hear about, the most famous companies, maybe less so, but 99% of companies go through hardship and adversity, and the entrepreneur has to be able to power through that. One way I describe it is that it's the characteristic to be able to believe even when you don't believe. I mean, intellectually, you're going to be in situations situations where you know it's not likely that you're going to succeed. Even to start a company, intellectually, you're going to know you're not likely to succeed. And the ability to be able to suspend that disbelief and still keep executing, I think is something you have to have as an entrepreneur, which is not natural. I mean, it's not natural to suspend your belief in something and keep grinding forward. It's an unnatural thing to do.
What do you think allowed you to do it? Is it the partnership with Frederick, where when one, you know, suddenly feels the disbelief, the other is in suspension of it? Or is it this, what is it that allows you to do that, do you think?
I think that there's, and Freddie is very important, my co-founder Freddie, he's very important, obviously. I think all founding teams and team members are important in successful companies. But more than that, I think it also is just, you know, my relationship with my wife and my family life gave me a solid foundation, right? So kind of a safety net. And like, I know even if this all doesn't work out, I'll still have all that. You know, we were able to save up some money. So I had a little bit of a nest egg if Okta didn't work out, which helped. But then after that, you just have to have a desire to want to prove something and want to prove people wrong and prove that you can do it. You got to be stubborn that you're going to keep going and you have to do it, even like sometimes when you don't believe.
One thing that you've put on Twitter actually quite a few times is people's ability to hire the best beneath them and the teams that they build being kind of an embodiment of like their quality. How do you think about that as a sign of truly great entrepreneurship? And I guess, how do you implement that like hiring framework today?
I think you have to focus on it. And I think that it might sound strange when I say focus on it, but in the early days of a company, it's a little bit more obvious, like, because if you're going to grow, you have to hire people. It's very clear. Like when you have one person, you can double the team by hiring one, right? And then two, three, and four, and so on. So early days, it's clear you have to focus on it, but it's not very long. Your company is not very big where it's easy to focus on other things, whether you're the CEO or whether you're maybe just the first line hiring manager. It's easy to focus on your day-to-day, what you're trying to build that day, or whatever your role in is the company. Or especially as a CEO, once you get like 50 people or 100 people, there's always so much stuff to do. It's easy not to focus on hiring and talent, because hiring and talent's hard. So, you know, focus on it, talking to people, reaching out, you know, being involved in the recruiting loop. It's focus is really important.
Is that not why you hire ahead of people? I agree with you. There's so many different things to focus on. And so you hire ahead of people early and they own that function. And then you have...
It's an and. I mean, you have to do both. One of the, I think, the mistakes we made early in Okta is we didn't hire recruiters, full-time recruiters that worked for the company. This is obviously very early, but we waited too long to hire full-time recruiters. We tried to use contingency recruiting firms. We should have doubled down on head of people and recruiting team much earlier.
How do you know when's the right time though? Because like with hindsight, it's easy, but when budgets is much smaller and you know growth isn't as obvious, how do you know when's the right time?
I think as soon as you're going to hire, you should invest in the people to hire. And I remember thinking the same thing. It was you know, money is tight. What if we kind of don't succeed and we don't need all these people? But the reality is that the company was being built to grow and being capitalized to grow and being funded to grow. It was pretty short-sighted to think that we shouldn't invest completely in all the things we needed to do to grow at the most effective, to make all those functions effective, and people and recruiting being one of those. So that's another way to say it, maybe more succinctly, is that if we didn't need the recruiters because we couldn't hire, we were screwed anyways.
Can I say, you mentioned there about not hiring recruiters early enough. When you think about the hypergrowth journey, what were like some of the first things to break?
I think getting back to your previous question about recruiting, it is a really important question. So I just want to say one more thing about that. There's also a temptation to, when you're trying to hire talent, is especially as the company is growing and evolving, it's to kind of pitch the company or the opportunities or the challenges as maybe something they're not. You know, maybe you're doing something in the company that's not the sexiest thing in the industry. Maybe it's, you know, there's more problems in the company or the industry or the opportunity than you'd want to admit to someone outside the company. I found that you should go the other way than your instinct. You should be super transparent about that and embrace what you are. Like, don't try to be the coolest thing on the block. Embrace what you're doing. It's more effective because it comes off as more genuine and self-selects the right kind of people. Like, it self-selects the right kind of people that are actually going to be motivated and stick around with what you're trying to do. And it's going to help out people that are interested in solving the problems you have because you just told them the problems you have versus trying to hide them.
I'm too intrigued not to jump on that. And in terms of the transparency there and the problems that you have, like, I'm a big believer in kind of vulnerability kind of built within leadership. How do you think about vulnerability within leadership? And is there ever too vulnerable? And what's that kind of scale for you?
I definitely think you can be vulnerable to a point where it's almost you're a downer. You know, I have this problem and I have this angst and I have this hang up and this is messed up, and you come across as a complainer or as it's just not productive. And I think that a good way to think about that is the objective is to build trust and loyalty and camaraderie, whether that's with a recruit or whether that's someone on your team or someone that's working for you or your person that you're working for. And you probably should be open and vulnerable and try to build that trust to the level that you can build trust and can build a relationship and can build a feeling of team and camaraderie, and probably not much more. Because once you get there, it's like you can go into the zone of maybe complaining too much.
How do you build that trust? You mentioned the ownership element from PeopleSoft. How do you make people feel like owners and feel like your trust in them is unwavering? How do you do that literally?
I think transparency and communication are a big part of it, because one thing about the owner is they know what's going on. Sometimes it's hard for the boss to know what's going on, and we can talk about that. But usually if you own something, you have knowledge about how it's going, what are the implications, what are the choices, what are the trade-offs. So the more information you can share, I think the more it feels to people like they're owners. So that's one important part. Another important part is thinking about what you trust people with and what decisions you trust them to make. And is it an environment where all the decisions are pre-decided and it's just kind of up to the person to pick the right path of a preset menu? Or is it really more creative and there's more flexibility for people to make these decisions and have autonomy? Now, I think this is always a tension, and especially in Okta, like, we have not totally nailed this, right? There's lots of areas where there's a lot of process, and some areas, frankly, where there has to be process. You can't just have people creating and being freestyling how they're going to do security reviews on code in production, right? So, but it is a think about, like, how can you share more information? How can you push down decision-making and remove process constraints in any way possible? And those two things right there are going to make people feel like they're owners to a large degree. And that leads to more loyalty. It leads to more creative problem solving. It leads to more better decisions. It leads to people feeling like they're able to trust their teammates better and a more cohesive group of people.
I do have to ask you mentioned kind of the team being owners there, and, you know, another kind of segment of the team, so to speak, is the board. I think it's super tough, like, first time founders, how the fuck are you meant to know how to manage a board? It's not like inherently obvious. So how do you think about, like, your biggest lessons in what successful board management is? A lot of your board members said, like, Todd's the man for this one. How do you think about what successful board management is?
Well, I think it's evolved. A board of a venture-backed Series A, Series B company is very different than a board of a growth stage scaling company is very different than a public company board. I think first big lesson I learned is that when you're small, when you're Series A, Series B, venture capitalists on the board, the board's just kind of forming as a team. The instinct I had was these were my bosses, right? They were, you know, and traditionally in my experience, your boss had the answers. Not always, but a lot of times your boss had the answers or knew what they were doing more than you did because they had more experience. I get into this job where I'm running Okta, and my instinct was to kind of throw out my opinion and lay out the options and then kind of ask the board what to do. And this Harry was not good.
What happened?
This was like, well, it seemed like, you know, it made sense in my mind, right? It's like, they're my boss. These guys are all rich and they have, you know, they do these multi-million dollar investments. I probably should just tell them all the stuff I'm thinking about and then kind of throw it out there on what we should do. Because I don't want people telling them what to do, right? But in reality, think about what that looked like from their perspective. They're looking for someone to drive and lead this company in a new thing that's going to be hard to do and there's going to be a lot of risk. And then I come into the board meetings and basically say, like, what should I do? So I learned quickly, only after a few meetings, that was totally wrong. The right way to do it is come in there strong and be, you know, open to input, of course, and be transparent and share information, but end it with a very strong statement about this is what we should do. You know, this is where the product should go. This is how we should think about go to market. I know that there's been conversation and you've seen seven other companies do it differently, but this is why we're doing it. And the reality is that, you know, although I'm not totally sure sure about anything because this is such an uncertain new company that I am certain about this is our direction and this is where we're going. Do you have any comment?
You know, when you think about getting the most value from them, because there are pearls of wisdom, there are lessons, there are anecdotes, what would you say in terms of extracting the most value from your board?
I talked about, you know, different stages. The board is different at different stages. This is actually one that's consistent across all the stages I've seen. You're going to get better input from the board the more you equip them and arm them with context. If you don't share much context and you kind of leave them guessing or speculating about the context of what's going on in the business and the industry, the quality of their input is going to go down. But if you spend the time and you focus on keeping them up to speed, and there's going to be a lot of different ways to do this. It can be, you know, conversations you have with them frequently and regularly. It can be, you know, monthly updates. It can be, you know, you can ask the board to talk to people on the management team regularly. But the more you can get them context, the better input you're going to get, and the more they're going to understand you, and it's going to make everything run better. Even now, as a 3,000 person public company, the board is, it's bigger. The board is, you know, it has a big part of its job is now governance, versus in the early days it was like trying to make the thing survive. But if we work really hard on making sure that the board knows what's going on, has context, we have a lot of material that goes out organized in a way that's easy to absorb, so that when we come to ask them something, we say, hey, listen, what do you think about this product strategy direction where we're going to try to appeal to this new buyer? Is that going to fly? Is it not going to fly? They're more armed to give you valuable input. It's never going to be like the end all be all because they're not running the company, but you can greatly improve the chances of that input being high quality.
Can I ask, you mentioned kind of the changing nature of the board there and it being more governance orientated when it's, you know, a public company. The thing that I'm so fascinated by, and I'd love your take on this, is like, you know, when you're public, you've got to think about quarter by quarter numbers and, you know, hitting the street's expectations, but you also have to retain that big picture of just what Okta could be in 5 to 10 years time. How do you think about hitting the numbers for next quarter and also maintaining that vision? How do you hit the balance?
Well, before we went public, I was worried about this. Like, you hear the stories about, you know, investors, Wall Street has short-term viewpoint, it's quarter to quarter, you're on the treadmill, you can't invest, et cetera, et cetera. And what I found is that investors, public market investors are, I know this is a big shock, but they're people. And people have a lot of similarities across the spectrum from the earliest venture investor all the way to a public market investor. And one of those things is that they don't like surprises and uncertainty, right? So to have good investor relations, I think you have to start from a foundation of predictability. People ask me all the time, like, you know, should I go public? Should I not go public? Or people debate this all the time. And I think that it's a lot harder if you don't have a foundation of predictability in the business, right? If your business is bouncing all over the place and, you know, might have a bunch of upside, but there's going to be a lot of variability, it's hard to do this effective investor relations because it's hard to set expectations. And one of the greatest things about SaaS and cloud computing is that we have this recurring revenue that gives a very stable business, and it makes it much more possible to set realistic expectations with investors. So once you set that foundation and you kind of can set here's the expectations, there's predictability. Yes, there might be a little bit of variance from it, but it's not going to be dramatic. Then you've earned the right to kind of tell your big story and tell your long-term vision. And by the way, Harry, they want that too, right? Because you've self-selected by the way you tell that story, the right kind of long-term growth investors, and they want a big vision, right? They don't want you to say, investors don't want you to say, you know, you're going to beat numbers for 2 quarters. They want you in 5 or 10 years to build a big company, because those are the, you know, we've set expectations, we've communicated that's our goal. So we attract those kind of investors. So anyway, that's been pretty interesting.
Can I ask final one before quick fire? It's like, that's expectation setting. In terms of goal setting, the big challenge that I have is, and I would love your thoughts on it, is like, when you think about setting really lofty, ambitious goals for the team, that's crucial. But you also don't want to set goals that are too ambitious where they become demoralized, disincentivized if they don't hit them. How do you balance between the two and find the right medium?
It's a hard problem. I mean, you know, there's debate all the time, even internally at Okta, about, you know, KPIs, our quarterly KPIs. What's the right result? Is the right result all red, or is the right result all green? And we go back and forth on it. You know, in engineering, it's like hitting your monthly sprint commitments. Is it better to try to do 10 things and do 8, or try to do 5 things and do 4? Or I guess that would be the same, but try to do 6 things and do, you know, 5. You know, obviously, it's, we want eight, like we don't want five, but you know, higher percentage of commitment is 5 out of 6 versus 8 out of 10. So it's definitely, it goes back and forth. What I've found is that, and this is not just for the CEO, I think any person in a leadership position, the first thing you have to do is you have to paint the high level long-term vision. You have to do that. If you think that you need more tactical, achievable goals, that may or may not be true in some situation, or you may or may not be like hindering the productivity by setting not lofty enough goals, but you got to set the long-term vision first. You have to tell people where you're going. You know, you have to get them excited about the fact that, like at Okta, it's like, we're not building identity. We're trying to help anyone use any technology. We're trying to set the identity standard for everything. Even though, like, you may say, well, what does that even mean, Todd? I don't understand. It's very vague. Well, yeah, that's true, but at least it sounds cool and it's bold, right? It can be inspiring to people. And that's important because people want to, and if they're going to own something, they want to own something worth something, right? They want to own a mission that is, you know, worth working on. And this can be applied all the way at any level of a company, an organization. You can be running technical operations at a small company. And if you get up there in front of your team of 5 people and say, you know, our job is to get, you know, more deployments done this month than last month, that's good. But it's more important to say, you know, we're going to set the standard in the industry on for how DevOps is done, because DevOps in the industry is screwed up and we're going to be the best DevOps team in the world. So something like that, right?
Yeah.
And then talk about, and by the way, we got to do that by having 5 things done out of 6 this month.
Yeah, don't forget those 5, by the way. I do have to ask, and the final one I promised before Quickfire, and it's like, you know, like one of the sexiest public companies over the last couple of years. Why do you think that is the case when Okta maybe in prior years wasn't like the sexiest company? Why do you think it's transitioned to be like the darling, other than just pure amazing performance, which is obvious?
It's a good question. I think it's a combination of a couple things. One thing is that we're very, very fortunate that the macro trends have gone our way. And what I don't mean like economy, I mean like the industry trends. So we started with identity, and it was really identity around helping the transition to cloud computing. So building this identity platform would help the transition to cloud computing. And that was how we started. Over the last decade, you've seen not only workforce and employee technology go to the cloud, but you've also seen at the same time, every company have to build a better website and mobile app as the whole economy transitions to the internet. And guess what? Identity is at the center of that too. And that's something I didn't anticipate. I didn't anticipate, you know, 10 years ago saying it's not only going to be workforce technology, but it's also going to be every customer interaction is going to be online, and that's going to need identity. So that's the second fortunate macro trend. And then the third one is just security is more relevant and pressing than ever. And if you look at, if you're going to try to do things without the VPN and in this flexible remote work environment, guess what's at the center of that? That's identity. So we were fortunate in that these long-term secular trends have gone our way, which is a big part of it. And then the second part of it, I think, is we've been very true to ourselves and consistent with our story. You know, public market investors, we've been public about almost 4 years, but we've been talking to them for 6 years, right? And talk about boring. We've been saying the same thing for 6 years. And so we get sick of saying it. Like, we get sick of saying the same thing, but they love it because it's like, oh, it's consistent. I've just been talking to Todd for 6 years and he comes in here the same every quarter and says the same thing. And then you layer on top of that, the performance, I think that's to the degree we've been successful, that's why.
Yeah, you always underestimate how much credit you get for doing what you said you'd do, I found.
Yeah, even back to the earliest days of Okta, I remember when Freddie and I first raised money, our first investor was Andreessen Horowitz, and we saw them in the summer of 2009, like in August or July. And we told them at the time, we said, this is our plan. And they kind of like, it was very early, like we were their first investment actually as a fund. And very early for us, I'm not sure if they even understood what we were doing or liked, but they liked us. And we said, hey, what we're going to do is in 6 months, we're going to have a paying customer and a product that works. That was basically our pitch. You can decide if you like the idea or not, but we're going to make this work in 6 months. And then in 6 months, they did a little seed round first. And then in 6 months, we came back to them. We said, here's the customer. And their customer, by the way, was paying us $500. So it wasn't like a huge deal, but it said, and it works. And they're up and live. Andreessen and Mark and Ben and Scott and the team there at the time, which was very small, is like, wow, these people actually said what they're going to do. And they went out and did it. So that's been kind of our mantra for over the years, is like, execute. You know, if you say you're going to do something, do it. And I think that's permeated the culture and helped us on the, you know, helped us throughout in customer relationships and partners and investors. And it's been important.
What's been the biggest takeaways from working with Mark and Ben? They are these hailed figures of our industry. Have there been some big takeaways from working with them?
I think Ben has been on the board, and he's, you know, been been immensely helpful to me on multiple levels, just as a CEO and as a friend. They're systematic, like, right? And a lot of this is, they're systematic in how they approached their industry and how they built their firm and how they had this positioning of, we're going to help the entrepreneur, we're going to invest in things in the firm to help entrepreneurs and execute on that. And really investing in front of problems and investing in areas that could have ROI. So I learned a lot just watching them build their firm and the analogies to building a company in terms of where to invest and so forth. And I think that it was a long time where they were growing faster than we were. I remember I'd get mad. I was like, oh my God, they have like 40 people and we only have 15 people. Like, we're the company. We're supposed to be getting bigger. And up until they had, I think, you know, they had about 100 people and then we passed them at that point. But for a long time, they were investing so much in helping entrepreneurs and building out the infrastructure for a firm. They were bigger than us. So that was, learned a lot from that.
That's very funny to hear in terms of scaling headcount. I do want to move into my favorite though, Todd, which is the quick fire round. So I say a short statement and you hit me with your immediate thoughts. Are you ready to rock and roll?
Ready to rock.
Okay, so what's the favorite book and why?
Slaughterhouse-Five, Kurt Vonnegut. For those of you who haven't read it, it's kind of about World War II and the horrible firebombing of Germany in World War II. So it's kind of I like the way it looks at history in a new perspective. But I don't think that's why it's my favorite. I think why it's my favorite is because just the writing in it and the clarity of the writing and the unique style of the writing it always blows me away.
Yeah. What does the daily work routine look like? That's from Frederick.
It's balanced. You know, it's balanced between a lot of meetings, a lot of discussion, a lot of back and forth. And it's really balanced across different functional areas. Some leaders have over-rotate toward product or sales, or I tend to be pretty balanced. One of the things I found is that I need time to ponder. My personality is that I need to chew things over in my brain. Some people just get energy off talking and off going back and forth on issues or interacting with people. I need time to ponder. So if I have too many back-to-back-to-backs, I just start to lose steam and just start to lose energy in them. So try to build in time to ponder as well.
What's the hardest element of your role today with Okta, Todd?
It's building the context to make good decisions. It's the CEO filter, I call it. Everyone that talks to you is putting on their CEO filter. Like, what does the CEO want to hear? What does he not want to hear? What kind of mood is he in? It's natural, right? Anytime you talk to someone that has a prominent position, you're going to want to be careful a little bit. And I find that sometimes impedes my ability to figure out what's going on and get that context to make good decisions. So I do a lot of things. I have relationships with people that I've known a long time that I trust will give it to me straight. I try to take conversations in unique ways that are harder to kind of have a canned response for. I'll be nice. I don't want to be mean to anyone. I try to be open too, and just make it clear to people that you can share the truth with me and I'm not going to fly off the handle and do something irrational because you said something I don't like.
Tell me, what three traits would you most want your children to adopt?
I want my kids to be kind to other people and not treat other people badly. So the golden rule, treat other people like you'd want to be treated. That's one. The second one is I want them to understand the way that focus and working on something can lead to results over time. It's more than just hard work. It's hard work, but also understanding that consistent hard work in a single direction is what adds up to success. The third thing is I want them to find what makes them happy and follow it. You know, not what makes someone else happy, not what makes me happy. I want them to find their own calling and follow it, because there's a lot of problems and people have a lot of unhappiness because they're trying to follow something that's for someone else, not for themselves.
Which leader do you most look up to, Todd, and why?
I think and this person I've known since PeopleSoft, actually. He, you know, along with Anil, Peter Gassner. I worked with Peter Gassner at PeopleSoft. Peter Gassner has been my mentor for a long time. We actually worked together at Salesforce too. And he's the CEO of a company called Veeva right now, which is a very successful SaaS company. So I get a lot of good input from him. But it's more because we have this close relationship and we can talk about this real substance of things. Where I find other leaders, which I don't know as well, sometimes I find the advice or the input to be a little bit trite or a little bit kind of toned down for mass consumption, where I find it more valuable when I can have a super deep conversation with someone I know and trust about what's going on.
Yeah. No, I totally agree in terms of the directness there. Penultimate ultimate one, and a tough one here, but it's just me and you, Todd, so don't worry about it. Who's the best board member that you've worked with and why?
Yeah, it's a lot of good ones, but I think Ben Horowitz is the first. He's been there from the very early days, so we have a special connection. And also, we're compatible, like in the way we think about things. Pretty logical thinkers. Our first instinct is to kind of ponder and figure things out and then talk and communicate. So we're really compatible. Not that I don't love all my children, though. I love all my children.
Of course. And then final one, paint the picture for me. What do the next 5 years hold for you and for Okta? What does that look like?
Oh, I'm pumped up. I think this is a lot because, you know, I founded Okta and I was there from the very, you know, when it was nothing. And I know how hard it is and how fortunate and lucky you have to be to make it to where we are now. And it's such a platform to accomplish what we could accomplish next with the brand and the team and the customer base. And so we're building this universal identity platform that's being used for workforce and customers. And, you know, we have a lot of cool stuff we're doing about standardizing internet and standardizing security. And that's going to lead to more impact. And ultimately, it's going to lead to better technology adoption in the world and better, safer use of technology in the world, which is what we're all about, which is what fires us up.
Todd, we've completely ruined the schedule here in terms of 20-minute VC, but this has been so much fun to do. So thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's great to be here, Harry. I really enjoyed it. Can't wait to do it next time as well.
I mean, what an incredible journey, and I can't believe it. I actually got an answer for the favorite board member. Huge thank you to Todd for being so open, honest, and direct with the questions. Really was such a pleasure. If you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, you can on Instagram at hstebbings1996 with two Bs. However, before we leave you today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll. And for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Check them out at carta.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20 VC listeners get 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50-plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. As always, I so appreciate all your support and I can't wait to bring you an incredible The Memo episode on Wednesday with Jeremy Liu on his seed investment in Snapchat.